Welcome to a podcast about the most awarded drama series in television history.
Did we remember to put applause in at the beginning? Hello, everyone.
I hope you did.
Thank you for joining us on Game of Thrones. We're joined by Brendan Beefish, a.k.a. Jeff, one of our best friends in the world.
What's up, guys? Good to be with you all again. It's exciting to be talking about Game of Thrones as well as talking about two chapters from A Feast with Dragons that I absolutely adore. One which in particular, which you'll find out about soon, which I like more than almost any other chapter in the entire series. But yeah, it's great to be back and happy to be talking with you all again.
I remember long conversations when we were crafting A Feast with Dragons together. And it's sad that Hannah can't be on this show. I think she saw Kanye West this week, and now she's been at two different weddings.
I saw all those posts on social media. I was surprised to see Hannah out at a Kanye
Easy,
concert.
Easy, season four.
I can see it.
But these chapters are immensely important, and we wanted to make sure to put in all of the effort that we possibly could, because I don't know about you guys. I'm really very excited. This Davos chapter for me, I remember on my first read through, and I think that we're just going to go right into this because it's hard not to. We've been excited to talk about this all day. It's the first day of a season. I can't talk of football for all three of us, and we're very excited about that as well. It's just good. It's just good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I understand you're a Vikings fan, and they won today with their backup quarterback, if I'm not mistaken.
It was a magical day.
And the Ravens eked out a victory, which is also good.
Micah?
Pass. Unfortunately, the Jets lost on a field goal that was kicked by their former kicker, who's now on the Cincinnati Bengals. So,
can you borrow him?
Yeah, go for
it. So you know that George R. Martin's is a huge Jets fan, right?
Micah? I do. Yeah,
and
I wonder if he was at the game.
He probably. I think he's back in Santa Fe right now. But if you look at his blog, probably next week, circa Monday or Tuesday, you'll see a post by him talking about the Jets losing their game and how awful it was for him.
Yeah.
But it's not all bad because he's also a Giants fan too. So he splits the difference, mm-hmm. and he has one win and one loss for this week.
I see. See, I didn't know as much about the Giants fan. I knew that he was pretty passionate from a Jets standpoint because when I do see him post on his blog, I happen to often catch the posts that he makes about the Jets, and they're usually not overwhelmingly positive. So, but that's the life of a Jets fan. So,
how do you think this affects the Winds of Winter?
Well, that's interesting because a friend of mine, Walt Hickey, he writes for 538. He's talked about how there's a correlation between positive seasons for the Jets and the Giants and how quickly A Dance with Dragons was written. And so he's saying, like, you should be, if you want the Winds of Winter out sooner rather than later, you have to start rooting for the Jets and the Giants and start winning lots of games, because George tends to write faster when he's in good spirits after a football win by either of those teams.
We talked about the Peter Reed mystery last week on the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for helping shed some light on that. And I think being one of the leaders of the communal detective work that was happening, that was really, really exciting there for a few days.
It was. And then it all got shattered when George's editors came out and said, no, sorry, there's no Winds of Winter release date or anything. He's still working on it. It's not done. And we'll announce it to the world. Once the world hears about it, or once the Winds is published, the entire world will hear about it type stuff. So, yeah.
So based on the outcome of week one NFL games, you would say that George R. R. Martin is writing at a steady pace.
It has
not gone in one direction or another.
Yeah, probably a pretty average pace right now. With the Jets losing on that heartbreak, we might see the death of another Stark in the Winds of Winter.
That's what I'm worried about, honestly. Once that kick went through the uprights, especially being from the Jets, several years ago, it's like, you know, being a traitor. It's almost like, you know, a Roose Bolton or somebody along those lines. Like, it's, I don't know.
It's heartbreaking.
It's perfect. I'm flying to Minnesota next week for game two at the new stadium. And I'm so glad that we can talk about football and it have something to do with this show on the show. Thanks for having me.
Well, and I know before we jump right into the chapters at the top, we briefly mentioned that Game of Thrones took home 9 creative Emmys, or at least I was alluding to that fact, which, you know, allowed them to break records that were held by the West Wing and Hill Street Blues. I was a big West Wing fan. I'm not as much a big Hill Street Blues fan, but this is big, and, yeah, and hopefully it's a very good sign heading into the Emmys, which are next Sunday, September the 18th. We know that they're up for a number of big awards there, and you know they cleaned up last year. Hopefully the trend continues this year.
Yeah, definitely.
As long as Breaking Bad isn't nominated.
Oh gosh.
I still think like somehow they're going to weave their way back in.
Well, you don't have Breaking Bad and you don't have Mad Men this year. So Game of Thrones seems like it would be on a good footing for several of the awards they're nominated for. I think, especially in the, which awards are they nominated for again? I haven't kept up as much.
Many. We talked about it a few weeks ago or a few months ago. I forget. We had the same thoughts last year because we were in the same situation. I think Mad Men was close by, but season 5 pulled out. I know that the voting rules changed starting last year, and we talked about that on one of our Emmys episodes last year. But if you guys remember how we felt about season 5 and how everyone felt about season 6, I feel more confident going into this season than I did last year.
I would say so too. And I think there has been, at least between season 5 and 6, there's been a lot of call it improvement on some of the things that made season 5 not as critically or popularly acclaimed as previous seasons. But season 6 was outstanding in so many regards. I really, really hope that the show gets its due from the Emmy folks this year around.
Jeff, you and I, when we talk about 4 and 5, I know a lot of times our conversations default back to how are these not regarded as the blessed tome that number 3 is, you know?
It is. Yeah. So it's really cool. Like these two books, in my opinion, are Martin's strongest. And even those that might look askance at some of what they consider to be kind of the slow plotting of the books and the overused dialogue and things like that, also look at the writing and definitely see an improvement, at least in the prose that you see in books 4 and 5. And these two chapters really bring that out to the fore, especially Davos's chapter, which is one of my favorite chapters in all of A Song of Ice and Fire, just because of the setting and those little history dumps that you get, as well as all the little tidbits you get about Stannis back in the day being the master of ships and closing down these guys, and they're pirating or raiding, or they're shipwrecking rather. So it's really, it's a cool set of chapters that I think speaks to how strong the books are in terms of its structure. These two chapters definitely stand out in my mind, with Davos standing out in my mind as being one of the better chapters in all of A Song of Ice and Fire, and one of the better chapters altogether in the books themselves.
Micah, you know how we love Davos chapters steering us?
Literally and figuratively, I guess. Yeah, in this reread, because, you know, one of the things that, you know, I find interesting is going through this the first time, A Feast with Dragons. I know Brendan had a lot to do with how this was all formulated. Here you have Davos, who has been sent off to treat and to try and find a way to rally the troops. And then next chapter, you're back at the wall and you're dealing with Stannis, the man who sent him to do it. So I'm in agreement that I think that, you know, because I was somebody, honestly, when I read A Feast for Crows and I read Dance with Dragons, you know, the latter half of A Dance with Dragons was what I really enjoyed. And I didn't really enjoy, quite honestly, A Feast for Crows. And I thought that it was probably my least favorite of all of them. But as I've gone through and as I've done this reread, I find much more value in these books than I did before. You know, I was always somebody who was, oh, I love A Storm of Swords, my favorite book.
Right.
But I think we've all kind of experienced that. I don't know, Jeff, that's something that you feel similarly about, because, you know, you were just talking about how you feel that these books are some of his strongest writing.
Yeah. So one of the great things about these books, and this comes out especially in the John chapter, which we'll talk about, is that George really nailed down some of the narrative and thematic struggles that the characters are facing. Mm-hmm. And he talks about in the Davos chapter too, where Davos is thinking about, you know, maybe I should just go back to my wife and my kids, the two that are, you know, in relatively still not in alive. Harm's way, still alive and not with Stannis, because he has another son that's Stannis' squire. So Davos is thinking, like, maybe I should just, like, give up on this quest, because it seems really foolish, especially since he hears all of this bad news while he's in Sisterton, And then John, though, also has a struggle as well, where he's talking with Bowen Marsh and talking with him about the fate of the wildlings and whether they should let these people through. And to be completely honest, George does a really good job of giving Bowen Marsh's point of view a really sympathetic take, really. I mean, there's so much about what Bowen says in this chapter that you're like, well, that actually makes kind of a lot of sense. Like, why would we let these savages through that are just going to end up raping and murdering and pillaging through the North? But at the same time, John also has a point, which is, you know, we have to let these guys through or else they're going to be killed by the others and then resurrected as whites by the others. So there's no choice. But I mean, that's the great thing about this is that it brings that whole narrative struggle into play and also makes it so that you're not talking about some guy who has the right perspective and someone who has the wrong perspective. You're speaking about two people that have almost equally legitimate perspectives, in my opinion, going through it, and understandable ones too, that the reader can relate to. So that makes these chapters really strong. And looking at the canon of all of A Feast for Crows and A Dance of Dragons, this is something that George seems to have really nailed down in these books. You still have really awful and evil villains like Ramsay Bolton and Roose Bolton and the slavers in Yung Kai, but you also have people that have legitimate points of view that, you know, in the end, you know, spoilers, you know, Bowen Marsh ends up stabbing Jon Snow, and that's part of the underpinnings for that occur in this chapter where Bowen is talking, starts to come into conflict with his Lord Commander for completely sympathetic and somewhat legitimate reasons.
And through one of our most relatable characters, someone to guide us through the story, who has done so well and popularly among us, but also the audience of the show, Davos, we get invited into Lord Godric's presence. And we're treated, honestly, we're treated to this dark and dismal gothic chapter set inside of a place in Westeros that we haven't visited before. But as the chapter wears on, we learn about the kind of people that live here. We learn about their history. We learn about their situation with the lights and the light tower and how they think of storms versus the way that the rest of us that would be seafaring people that don't have settlements alongside a craggy shore think about storms. And it paints, again, a much broader picture of Westeros, but at the same time, zooms into the moment that Davos is feeling with this guy. And it's just, I remember reading it for the first time thinking, this is probably what people were talking about when I've heard over the years about the dragon commentary inside of these two books that couldn't be compared to kind of the steady action and the rise of A Storm of Swords. But when I read it, I was like, this is what I read high fantasy for. And this scene is unbelievably, I don't know, just it pulled me into it. Down to the moment when the trencher was hollowed out and filled with Sister Stew, I was just like, I am here. I feel this. I understand what's happening. Davos could very easily be killed in a moment's notice, but he's not.
Yeah, the setting's really cool, too. I mean, the chapter opens with lightning split the northern sky, etching the black tower of the night lamp against the blue white sky. Like that is some just, in my opinion, that's some glorious writing, like of setting the scene so well. So the reader is thrown into this setting where Davos is going to be confronted with someone. And, you know, isn't sure if he's going to come out of it alive. And you're not really sure he's going to come out of it alive until the very last lines of the chapter itself. And that's a really cool way of putting it. So you have the scene set for you, which I think it's intended to show both the setting as well as to show that Davos is entering into a very stormy situation in a place where he doesn't know the outcome, and which is frankly dangerous for him, incredibly dangerous for him. And this is only this first chapter in A Feast for Dragons.
Right.
So it's he's got a lot more danger ahead of him, but right now he's already thrust into this kind of, call it the danger zone. And in his very first chapter.
I mean, if he was in the prologue, then of course we would worry that it could well be his last chapter.
Right.
The end of the chapter, for me, the fact that his situation is almost parallel to something that Ned Stark experienced, I thought was a really cool way for George to write.
Oh, yeah.
Also just learning about Ned Stark in that same situation. I was like, thanks for that. At the tail end of an already brilliant chapter, you're going to give me just a small taste without the need for a flashback, just through, you know, conversation, how Ned Stark behaved and the throes of Robert's Rebellion.
Yeah. And that also, the other cool part about this chapter is that the other main character in this chapter is Godrick Burrell. And Godrick is interesting because we as the reader outside of the universe, we want Godrick to be like, yeah, help Davos out, send him to White Harbor, help him to win the support of Wyman Manderly for Stannis, or at least I guess maybe I'm speaking for myself because I'm kind of a pro-Stannis type of person. At least
these were your chapters then.
Yeah, exactly. But Godrick is he's a guy who's like, hey, look, if I put my neck on the line for this guy and he loses, like, we're fucked. Like, we are, like, if we put ourselves on the wrong side of this battle or of this war, then it's going to be the end for us. Like, they'll come and they will hang us all. They'll kill my people and they'll take my lands for forfeit and probably give them to someone else who's loyal to Tommen in this chapter. So basically Godrick is saying, hey, you know, I get what you're saying, man, but look, I don't want to put my neck on the line for a cause that isn't certain, but I'm also not going to put my neck on the line for the other cause, which is Tommen's cause and the Boltons' cause, because their cause is uncertain as well.
Everything changes now that Tywin's gone. And it was interesting to get that news directly. And we've been getting it staggered through the characters that we care about, and they all interpret it differently. But we've always come to trust Davos's judgment on the state of the realm and how it governs, while we're also being reminded constantly from inside of his head that he's lowborn and trash and doesn't necessarily have the respect enough for us to trust him like we do. But when he, in the moment, learns that Tywin's dead, that's when, you know, immediately he's like, well, this changes everything. Our position is so much better now. No matter Salador's son dropping me off into an open boat to paddle here in the middle of a storm. You know what I mean? Like, things can be different. And this is kind of like his first opportunity to make that happen. So thank the gods that Ned Stark came here, and also thank the gods that they learned their lessons from the Blackfyre Rebellion before.
Right.
Yeah. And the way that the story is told, again, you know, we've talked about it a lot on the show, you know, the sort of the lore behind how Tyrion, in fact, killed Tywin.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, it says the dwarfs escaped. He twisted through the bars of his cell and tore his own father apart with his bare hands. A guardsman saw him flee red from head to heel as if he'd bathed in blood. And, you know, it's a completely different story from what we hear in the next chapter. And even John, like, has that recollection about the fact that this was a man that, you know, considered himself to be a friend of John's. So, you know, it's the same as, like, as we've gone through and heard tales that have been passed on to different places. You know, it's all different, just like pieces of information, but just how this world seems to work.
Except this time it's not in an inn at the crossroads. It's a fellow lord telling Davos that Tyrion did this. And it just makes me so nervous about the fact that he's coming back to Westeros to the tales of this happening.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting to see the different perspectives and also to see the information fog, which would take place in a world like Westeros, where you're not 100% sure whether the information is being conveyed is correct or not. You know, we know as the reader that Tyrion didn't pry through the bars and then bathe in his father's blood. He was let free by Jaime and then shot his father with a crossbow. The essence of it is true, but the particulars tend to be obscured by just the information fog that tends to impact the way that news reaches various parts of this world.
What do you guys think the readers were meant to believe? Because George did design these chapters. It happens in our reading order that John does follow Davos. But until you turn that final page, we're stuck inside the realm of Davos speaking to Godrick Burrell. What do you guys think was meant to be taken away here? Obviously, the reflection of Ned's line being spoken again, or at least him acknowledging that this is basically going to be the same situation that Ned Stark was in before, but obviously not as good in his favor. Here in Sisterton, that's not a priority. This is a pirating haven, you know, like this is the place for that kind of stuff. It's the other side of the coin when it comes to folks like the Greyjoys, that, you know, they don't still read, but I believe that they were definitely those kinds of people in the past. And I just think that it has so much to do, geographically speaking, but also story related, with the kind of people that Davos is talking about or is talking to. I just feel it adds to what we're supposed to feel from this, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah. So the people, the Sistermen, as they call themselves, are an interesting people in that in their history, they were basically the Ironborn of the Narrow Sea, whereas the Ironborn were out in the Sunset Sea. But after a time, they found that they could do the same thing without the same danger by lighting these things called night lamps, which will keep you safe and, you know, in the best of all worlds. But at the same time, they'll also light false ones, and they'll direct ships to crash on the rocks, and then they'll just rob the ships after they've done crashing into the rocks themselves.
And why risk that kind of lifestyle, a lifestyle where an entire pound of saffron can break upon your shore that the storm brought to you, or all these delicious niceties that Lord Godric is enjoying? He's basically asking Davos, why would I risk all of this? And Davos is kind of thinking to himself, I'm not sure why he would, but it's almost Lord Godric that says, because of what's happening with Tywin. You know, like, what does he say? He says, if I thought it were Sir Kevin leading the kingdom, then you would have entered this room in chains. It's like, damn. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, get to the rest of this book and you'll really understand. I don't know. It's just really clever foreshadowing through the use of this conversation, while also kind of telling us how we should feel about it. Not that we would need to question it later on as we go through the book.
And speaking of foreshadowing, or maybe it's just little nuggets that are dropped in there, but there was a mention of a couple of galleys that crashed off of Skagos.
Oh yeah.
As well as the fact that little bit later in the chapter, I believe it's Godric who talks about how he won't eat spider crab. In a way, I looked at that or interpreted it as being a form of cannibalism, right? It's his house sigil. So he wouldn't go out and eat something that represents his house unless it was like cooked a certain way. But again, I thought a little bit of alluding to where Davos may be headed in the future.
Yeah, it's definitely. Is it the next John chapter? Because I'm actually a little bit ahead of you guys in the reading, where John is talking about that he hears about another ship that's shipwrecked off of Skagos, and he thinks that it might be Sam's ship that shipwrecked, and he's kind of concerned that it might be Sam who's actually stuck on this island of alleged cannibals, and. Yeah, it's interesting. It definitely speaks to Davos's future. I think it foreshadows a lot of what's going to happen to him as his chapters progress in A Feast for Dragons. It's cool though.
There's definitely concern on John's part in the next chapter that, based on everything that he's heard, that he basically sent Sam and Aemon and Gilly to their death. I don't know if it specifically mentions Skagos, but. There is a part where he's definitely concerned about their safety.
I'm concerned, and I know what happens. Can we talk about Skagos for a second? It's hard to just touch on a place that's roamed with the dystopian race of cannibals and not give it a little bit of respect, because that's so cool.
Skagos is a really interesting place because it's technically sworn to the Starks, but in reality, it basically rules themselves, almost very similar to how the Sisters are ruled technically by the Arryns of the Vale, but in reality, they basically rule themselves. They don't really have much to do with the other houses in the realm. One of the things that I think is interesting about Skagos itself is that you have all these stories about cannibalism and about unicorns. And in the World of Ice and Fire, it actually talks about how there is unicorns on Skagos, that they've been confirmed that maesters have seen them off of the coast when they're sailing around the ship, the island itself. One of the things that I find interesting and possible in Skagos is that the Skagosi are trying to keep themselves independent or autonomous. And so they spread these stories about their cannibalism around all of Westeros in order to, so that people never,
fantastic,
will never visit their island. So they can be there. They could be Skagosi till the end of all time. But you know, I think that's an interesting possibility. I don't know if it's true or not, but it does make sense to me that maybe the Skagosi aren't as they seem, because that's something that George plays with as well, is that all of these people groups, like the wildlings, are not these savages that we think that they are with the start of the story, because we encounter characters like Mance Rayder and Tormund Giantsbane and Val, and all of these types of characters, but they're people at the end of the day, and they're not caricatures of what people in South of the Wall think that they are. And I think the same might apply for the Skagosi as well.
I think so too. I mean, I like that. That's one of George's overall points that he drives in. If there's five overarching points of the characters and the base humanity that they inhabit, and that's including the villains, the people that we don't know much about inside of the White Walkers, or even the deities becoming.
That's what we need though, Zach.
What do we need?
We need a Night King perspective chapter so we can get a full understanding yes. of what it's really like to be him.
Oh, gosh, the Skagosi lore is fascinating to me. And if you aren't familiar with the size of Skagos or its relative distance to the rest of the North, I suggest you Google a map or look inside of the World of Ice and Fire the next time you're in Barnes & Noble just to get a feel of it, because it's so interesting. When we think about the stakes of all that we're looking at here, and that's what's so great about going through the books chapter by chapter, because it kind of forces us to zoom in at certain points. But when we're not recording these episodes, or we're not reading for these chapters, or if we're not watching the television show, if you think about how much time that is compared to the rest of the time we have to think about Song of Ice and Fire or Game of Thrones, I know personally my mind is just everywhere in the ether of what are all like Ibn and Skagos and all these places that have lore that we can understand, but how does that relate to the characters that we are living with? You know what I mean? And at what point, if any, will they interact with their story, and what could that mean, and what sort of variables could sprout up from there? Because we have two books left and we don't know what that's going to look like. But I'd like to think that the Skagosi are still going to feel what's happening with the Night King approaching the South, even though they're so separated. You know what I mean? What do you think?
Oh, so certainly, I think that they're as much in danger as everyone else in Westeros from the Night King or whoever's leading the others in the books themselves. And they probably have their own lore about the others. One of the interesting things that comes out as the story progresses and into the World of Ice and Fire is that there are numerous legends about the others that tend to be transcribed or filtered rather through different cultural lenses and perspectives. You have legends about the others in the Far East, for instance, in Essos. And so you have to imagine that maybe the Skagosi have their own set of legends about the others, much as the North and people in Essos do as well.
And that's basically an allegory to the kinds of people that fill the story, whether they live on a cannibalistic island or whether they live in Winterfell before it was sacked. Whether they're free folk or whether they live in Carth and dress in weird ways, like they're all rooted in the same mm-hmm. culture, not the same geographical culture, but they all live on Planetos. And if something is happening, and we know that it is happening because we can see reanimated bodies with white faces and blue eyes walking around, at least in this fictional story. But since it is happening in their universe, you got to think that this isn't centrally, you know what I mean? Like we still don't, mm-hmm. we obviously don't understand the far-reaching potential that it's had. I'm just like, mm-hmm. my mind's going 1,000 miles per hour.
Well, in the same way that you know, we've talked about how Davos is really one of, if not the only perspective we get from a low-born individual in the series. To think that we're kind of gushing about him, you know, we love him from the way that Liam Cunningham plays him on the show, but you know, when we get to his chapters, we're always excited to read his chapters. I think, you know, and it's very easy to get behind his character and to want to see him be successful. So that's why this chapter, you're left kind of holding your breath a little bit. Yeah, he's kind of made it through the first task, but what's going to happen when he does go on to White Harbor? What's going to happen beyond? We don't know. And I think even though you feel a little bit of relief, you know that given the series, it's going to be short-lived.
Yep.
Salador did give him a chance, though. He said, look, you can come with me if you want. He's like, nah.
And he's given him many chances along the way.
Oh, yeah.
When Davos, I have the quote written down somewhere, but when Davos is going through all of the chances, all of that Salador has gone through for this forlorn promise from Stannis Baratheon, you really get to understand why he's making this decision.
But the thing is that the temptation to abandon Stannis is still there for Davos. He's not... He's considering it because he has this whole series of flashbacks to his conversations with Salador San, where he says stuff like, well, you know, Salador promised me, where he thinks of Salador promising him to take him back, and he'll pick up his wife and kids and leave all of this behind. But he doesn't, because he's a loyal man and he's loyal to Stannis. But it's an interesting character study in Davos that he has this yearning to go back to his family, but he's a king's man in the end. He's the guy that's going to hold on to Stannis, at least for the moment, until the bitter end. The question is whether that's going to continue as the series progresses, whether he's going to always be loyal to Stannis, or at some point he's going to go back and consider, maybe I should go back for my family and rescue them from, maybe I should have taken up Salador San's offer. And that's kind of an interesting question to consider as this story goes forward, is how much Davos is sacrificing on behalf of his king, a king that he definitely believes in, but a king that's asking an awful lot of this guy.
Definitely. I mean, he asks himself in this chapter, would Stannis ransom for me? After he made the decision to say no to a longtime friend, to leave all of the danger and possibly go save his family. I mean, obviously, I don't think we need any more evidence, but there's clear evidence right there as he makes his way to White Harbor against all odds that even though he's not sure that Stannis values him the same, Davos values his oath, he values his plight, and he values his king.
I think that he's a smart enough man to get himself through where he is right now, but it's tough to see him really now truly on his own, right? And it's just because the fact that Stannis has not been able to follow through on the promises that he had originally given to Salador San and his men. He refers to them as ice storms and empty promises, and the north is too cold and getting colder. So let's think about it. Do you want the north and the White Walkers, or you want to go sail off to, the equivalent of a tropical island and see your family? I mean,
what's interesting about that too, the moment that Salador San abandons Stannis is close to the time where Stannis actually receives the loan from the Iron Bank of Braavos to actually pay Salador San. So he could have gotten his payment if he had just waited just a little bit longer, and it actually helped Stannis for just a month or two more.
It's what holds this universe together, people. Men like Davos money. And Ned and money.
There's such a sense of irony in that, though, too, that, you know, George has built into the story so that it's amusing that Salador San is just so angry about, like, not being paid, and he's waited so long, and then at that moment where he's like, fuck it, I am leaving all of this behind. I am going to my tropical island where I can, you know, become a pirate again. I can actually make money. Is the moment where he actually would be able to recomp all of his losses and make some money off of Stannis.
If only he could be there when Mance Rayder is being executed to see that harshly glowing sword. Maybe he would have changed his mind.
There's actually, and this is another thing for more spoiler type territory as well, but the lights themselves in the Sisters, the night lamps, there was a great theory maybe 2 years ago that was written by a Reddit user named Can't Use, which talks about how Stannis might adopt the same tactics that he knows about from the Sisters in his battle against the Freys. Because so in the chapter itself, they talk about how Stannis came up to Godric Borel and was like, you guys need to like cut the shit and stop lighting these false lamps, or else I'm going to come up here and hang every single one of you.
Yeah.
But so Stannis is aware of this tactic that they use to lure ships across dangerous waters. Later in A Dance with Dragons, Stannis ends up in a place called the Crofter's Village, where he's in this village with a lake to his north and his south, and he has a watchtower that he keeps a fire lit across at all points in time in the later chapters. And so one of this guy's theory, and I actually really, really like it, is that Stannis will use the light from the tower itself to lure the Freys who are about to attack Stannis across the lake, which they've been punching holes through for the duration of their time there, in order to sink them in the waters themselves.
All right. That's a different kind of Frey pie, but I can get behind that one. Let's also use the same tactic on the White Walkers. Let's just have a lot of people pretend that they're dead, and have all the White Walkers come and, you know, like, okay, I'm going to come raise all of you from the dead. And you all gather around them, like, this is the guy I'm raising. It all works out. And then they one time rise and stab them with Dragonglass at the end. I don't think it'll work that well.
Probably not. You could always collapse the wall on top of the Walkers, too, if you really wanted to.
That's true. But wouldn't it just make them bigger, you know, when the ice just stick to them?
Well, and you then... can't do that now with the horn gone.
That's true. Or is it?
We'd like to take a moment to thank Blue Apron for sponsoring another episode of Game of Owns. You know that weekly present that arrives filled with delicious goodies?
You mean paprika spice shrimp and cheddar grits with tomato and sweet corn? Or summer udon noodle salad with cherry tomatoes, corn, and summer sweet pepper?
For me, the best part about Blue Apron are the ingredients. Individually packed, they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. The meat is always of the highest quality. The vegetables are always of the highest quality, and they're sitting beside the other vegetables that I pick up in the grocery store in my refrigerator, and it's something that I always notice.
And the best part is it's less than $10 a meal.
That's the part I've been talking to my mom and my family members about, because they're all I've had some free Blue Apron meals to send out to people, and it's been photo texting back and forth, and it's just been a sponsor I've been really happy to continue to work with us, and it's really exciting that so many of you have been having a good time with it as well. We've seen on Twitter, and it's just fun. So thanks to Blue Apron for continuing to support Game of Owns, but also I'm just glad that all of you are enjoying it as well.
Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/owns. That's blueapron.com/OWNS. You love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. Visit blueapron.com/OWNS.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Are we going to talk about this now? Because that's the moment when I texted you earlier, because I didn't know that it was this John chapter that we were talking about, but I feel like we were like going to talk about this at some point when we were doing Feast of Dragons, but we never, or when we were making it, but we never did. But this is... I have a lot of questions.
So yeah, that horn that they burn with Mance Rayder, is it actually the Horn of Winter that they burn? Is it actually another horn that they burn? Because John and his friends discover another horn when they're at the Fist of the First Men back in A Clash of Kings. Is it that the horn that they burn? Or is it they burn the horn that Mance has? Or is it
Euron's?
Yeah, or is it Euron's horn? Or is it whose horn is it they actually have?
I'm going to go out on a limb, though. I'm going to take a chance here, and I'm going to say that there's more than one horn that can be found as sort of this, you know, like these artifacts that have been around out beyond the wall for many, many years.
Or around the world.
I have a feeling around the world. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, is that really the horn?
I don't think that this is the horn.
Well, so I'm really curious about the horn that Mance has. I think that they burned the horn, Mance's horn, the one that the giants that was dug up by the giants apparently, or was held by the giants. But I don't think it's the Horn of Joramun, which is the horn that they all think that they're burning. I think the Horn of Joramun has yet to be found by men, although it's possible that the horn might turn up, say, when the White Walkers actually approach the wall at the in the Winds of Winter or in season 7 of Game of Thrones. It's possible that we're looking at a false horn. But there's another horn too. There's the horn that Sam takes down with him to Old Town. Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder which horn is that. Is that the horn of Joramun that they found? Or is that just another horn, just another random horn altogether, another false clue or a false horn that's not going to have as much of an impact because the true horn is yet to be blown.
You're saying that it's possible that the real horn could be in the hands of the White Walkers.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
That's a scary thought.
The words of Bowen Marsh, I think, really add a lot of weight to the wall. Remember when we were talking earlier, like, you know, he makes a lot of great points. The points that he were making, he was talking about the amount of arrows that the wildlings and their massive army, when they numbered over 100,000 soldiers, loosed, and how only one man fell to that. And that was due to a wound on his leg that made him fall. It wasn't actually the arrow that killed him. And that if they took certain measures, aka listening to some of John's thoughts on security on the wall, that they could really fortify it by covering the murder holes with ice and filling the tunnels with stone. All of these things that they could do to fortify the wall against not only Tormund Giantsbane's force opposing them, but also in my mind, I'm thinking directly, and I think that John was too, the White Walkers, because mm-hmm. first off, they can't cross the wall as it is, supposedly. We still don't know for sure, because we haven't actually seen them try. But, you know, you think to yourself, like, that's really true. And if that's what's keeping them out, why don't we try to stand on top of this hill and try to stay on top of all this? And so it makes me question my thought when I hear tales of the Horn of Jorm. And I'm not sure how you guys feel about this, but part of me feels like this could be another exercise in George R. R. Martin, like giving us this sort of superficial variable inside of this very real grounded society. Even though there is actually magic, we do know it exists. It's possible that this piece of lore, this Horn of Jorman, could be total bullshit, and that the wall, you know, doesn't have a faded horn that could destroy it, because the wall was built by people that were on that planet. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, there's a lot of variables there. And I think it almost directly contradicts the fact that the wall has to come down for the White Walkers to cross it.
Yeah, I think, like, they talk about that you don't put a gun on the wall if you're not going to end up using it in Act 3 of, like, a play. And I think the horn serves that purpose in the story, where it seems like it's going to be used. We haven't seen a horn. We saw the horn in the Kingsmoot, and we also know that there's that same horn is on its way to Meereen.
Right.
We didn't see any of the horns being blown. Mance threatened to blow the horn to take the wall down at the end of A Storm of Swords, but it wasn't blown. And I think it's possible that it's kind of one of those wait and see games where it's going to be blown at some point in the story itself, because we don't know what it's going to do. And that sense of, like, growing anticipation and perhaps dread, or definitely dread if the Walkers have it, is going to encourage George to write something of that nature, of the horn being blown and some horrific event occurring at the wall or in Meereen when the horn gets blown during the Battle of Meereen that's going to be occurring in the Winds of Winter.
Interesting. So you're saying that the dragon horn could, in fact, it was blown at the Kingsmoot, so it couldn't, in fact, like, beat the Horn of Jorman.
No, it's probably not the Horn of Jorman, but it has the same impact in that we don't know exactly what it does. Mm-hmm. We know that it's bad because the guy who blew the horn at the Kingsmoot dies, and they cut him open later, and they find his lungs are ashes. Completely black. Yeah, they're ashes. So we know that there's some sort of evil connotation involved in it, but we don't know what that's going to do when it's around dragons, or in the case of the wall, what's going to happen when the horn gets blown, if the horn gets blown around the wall and around something like Castle Black or something like that.
Do you think that these two horns are connected? Because stylistically, they're almost identical.
They could be. So I was actually looking at this. It says that they brought forth the Horn of Jorman, black and bandied with old gold, 8 feet long from end to end. Runes were carved into the golden bands, the writing of the first men. If recalling from some of Victarion's point of view chapters, the writing on the horn that they have is Valyrian glyphs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's two different horns, but I think they're connected. I think the runes that they talk about in the horn they burn, as well as the Valyrian glyphs, have some sort of magic embedded into them, or they speak about the magic embedded into the horns themselves.
Mm-hmm. And one is from, we can assume, Westeros, so one is from a different continent, but it goes back to kind of what we were mentioning earlier. These places are geographically separated, but we can assume that since they're so old, it is directly relative to the underlying threat or the underlying power that is coming out of this planet or that lives here. And my only thought is that if these horns are as faded as they seem to be, that it's an attempt for the people who live here to tame whatever those forces are.
Yeah.
I think it could also speak to Melisandre not really being, not necessarily who she appears to be, but as connected as she appears to be, right? Because she is burning this horn that perhaps is just a horn that was used beyond the wall to control mammoths, for all we know, right? And then she's burning the king beyond the wall as the symbol, but we know that her sacrifices have not yielded, I don't want to say anything of value, but they haven't had the results that she has anticipated. So I feel like it's almost, again, this idea of false pretenses of who she is And, you know, she's getting up there and she's rallying the Queen's men, and then they're saying what they need to say. And it's just, to me, it could just be another instance for her where she's acting the part and, you know, she's doing what she thinks is right. But at the end of the day, it's not going to have any meaningful effect, right? Because burning the horn, okay, if it's not indeed the horn, then it's meaningless. And then burning Mance, who isn't really Mance, is meaningless as well. I mean, it's just to maybe instill the fear, and we can talk a little bit about this, but into the wildlings, right? This was their king. So she wants to try and be able to rally them to Stannis, but Jon has warned her that, you know, this is not something that they're just going to turn around and say, okay, well, you've now burned Mance, so we're going to swear our allegiance to Stannis. Some of them do, but not all of them. The wildlings are their own people. They're free people and they do what they want.
The cool thing about that is that, you know, from Stannis' perspective, Stannis is a man that believes very much in the law. If Mance Rayder was a traitor and a turncloak to the Night's Watch, then he deserves to die. And the secondary effect of that is that Stannis thinks that he can win their support by showing that he's has killed their leader and now he's their leader. But the reality is that it's possible that doesn't do anything of the sort, that it makes Mance into a bit of a martyr, because he does it in front of all of the wildlings that are penned up at the wall itself. And that's really interesting, because we think if we're Stannis, we're thinking that we just have to take out the leader and then everything will move smoothly. But that's not really the case, as we see that a number of people say, you know, fuck all this, I'm heading back north of the wall rather than swear to Stannis. They're basically saying they would rather die than serve this guy who just burned their king. So it's really, it might have had an impact of having some people swear to them, but it also makes almost the same number of folks run away from Stannis.
And is it a real sacrifice, though, too? I mean, because Jon has his men intervene and effectively kill Mance before he's burned, right?
Right.
So did he mess up the plan?
Well, the sword glowed, but we know that it doesn't take King's blood to do that.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point, Micah, because in Davos's chapter, he talks about how fast they sailed from Dragonstone to Eastwatch. And he attributes it to when they burn Alistair Florent in the chapter itself, and how, like, they just made record time, and they had an evil wind, is how Davos terms it, pushing them north to the wall. But, you know, when Jon intervenes and prevents Mance from being sacrificed, does that then, you know, make it not a true sacrifice? I think it's a really great question, something I've never even thought about. So it's fascinating. I could definitely think about that and dwell upon that more.
That is true, because Melisandre was directly involved with this not going the way that it should have gone. And maybe things would have been different for Stannis if she had. It's interesting.
He got some Stannis eyes too.
He did get some Stannis eyes. But the sacrifices have worked, you know? Like, if we're to believe that, you know, through a reasonable man like Davos, who in our defense has seen a baby come out of her that was a shadow, believes that the hand of the king before him getting sacrificed had anything to do with the fact that they got wind, you know what I mean? Like, so we should put stock in some of this stuff. But I think that your question about the sacrifice in general, it matters so much, because you think about what you were later revealed about Mance Rayder and what we're led to believe about Mance Rayder in this chapter, and how the sacrifice is supposed to affect Jon, Stannis, all of the free folk. The fact that he steps up to the plate and completely denounces everything. He acts in the most un-Mance way that we could have imagined, right?
He straight up says, I'm not the king. If that's not a clue.
Well, it's funny how they do that, because Jon is like, well, you know, if he's facing the flames, of course he's going to say that he's not the king, you know, because no one in their right mind is going to try and, you know, boldly go into the flames. I mean, people just aren't that brave, right? I mean, almost everyone in this entire world and in the world of Westeros are not brave enough to face a horrific death bravely. So that's how John like looks at it. He's like, well, of course he would say I'm not the king. Right. And he denies right. himself because mm-hmm. that's really cool the way that Martin does it, because the reveal that happens later on really took me as a reader by surprise, because I ended up imbuing a lot of John's thinking, like, and just kind of like filtered it through, like, of course, like you're going to be burned to death. You're going to deny you're exactly. a king, and you're going to deny everything. And then when the reveal comes later, you're like, oh man, that's, mm-hmm. that's great. But it's definitely good writing on George's part to have, very real emotions and feelings and rationalizations built into John's thinking about the burning of Mance. And then to have that reveal later on that shows that John might have been thinking completely rationally and reasonably, but he was still wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he has those thoughts even when he sees the Lord of Bones later on in this chapter, and he thinks about Val and how she must think that somebody is like sniveling and cowardly as he is allowed to be living and breathing when Mance has just been sacrificed or murdered, however you want to look at it.
Yeah.
It says a lot about their people, and that's being all of it's like a big stew of references that are aggrandizing the different sects of people and giving more character depth to the different sects of people that are gathered here at Castle Black. And I really thought it was important that the way Melisandre addressed the wildlings, she insisted on calling them the free folk, and George insisted on telling us that that's the name that they prefer for themselves and not wildling. Like, he made a point to put both of those things in here, and I think that does a lot to foreshadow their relationship with the Night's Watch that eventually comes, and the people that oppose the wildlings and the kind of people that they are, but also Melisandre as well, who continues to raise in profile as a character that becomes closer to the hearts of the people that we actually care about, because we used to really abhor her, but it begins to pivot as we move forward.
George has talked about how Melisandre is his most misunderstood character by fans in all of Song of Ice and Fire, and I think like you start to see some of why that she's misunderstood by fans here, where she's doing something that's objectively a very rotten thing. You know, burning someone alive is just evil, objectively. But at the same time, you start to understand her rationale, and we actually get more of her perspective as the story progresses. We see that there's even more of a characterization to Melisandre about why she does these things and why she's also not infallible as well, which I think is another interesting topic which comes to the fore as her chapters progress in A Dance with Dragons.
And which we actually get in A Dance with Dragons, which escalates the matter even further.
Oh, yeah.
What did you guys think of the dream that John references that he had in this chapter? I know there was some talk about more towards the end of the chapter of him warging into ghost, or at least being able to taste the blood, as if a ghost had just gone hunting. But he has a dream just before they kill Mance Rayder, and he talks about how Sam was drowning, Ygritte was dying with his arrow inside of her, even though we know he wasn't the one to kill her, and of Gilly weeping tears of blood. And you know, any time that dreams are called out, I can't help but wonder if they're predicting the future in any way, or they're just horrible dreams because this is a horrible world that, you know, seemingly good people are just trying to make it through.
It's interesting about the dreams is because there's the dreams in the books themselves. Most dreams in the real world are generally meaningless, but in works of fiction, especially in The Song of Ice and Fire, they often have very significant meaning and big foreshadowing, especially for John going forward. So I don't have a good answer as to whether John's dream is going to become reality or true. I know with Ygritte, John feels that guilt that he betrayed her and the rest of the wildlings that were in his party with them back in Storm of Swords. And he feels very much like that he was the one that caused the woman that he, I guess, loved. To die. And that's very powerful for him. Very guilt producing for him as well. And then for Sam, that weeping of tears of blood has always been fascinating to me because they, it's very, I don't know what the word is, almost like speaks to, or was he the one weeping tears of blood?
It was Gilly.
It was Gilly. I mean, just thinking about it a little more, I wonder for Sam, is it just, okay, he's out on the open sea and he's not very athletic. Should something happen, you know, does he run the risk of drowning? And with Gilly, you know, just the fact that baby swap happened, is it, you know, something to the point where she's just so full of sorrow that she ends up crying tears of blood as opposed to just normal tears just because she's cried so much?
That's a tough question. And I gave this a lot of thought, and I tend to reread dreams in A Song of Ice and Fire, every mention, whether it comes from a character that we know that possesses the green side or not, over and over again, to overanalyze and sort of obsess about it. And I found it difficult to ignore this one from John, because it's John in this book, the book that began the way that it did, the book that reminded us of the taste of blood in his mouth again, what John possesses. So it's just tough, but I don't, you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing that I can draw on now. It's an interesting place to be, because we just don't know.
The alternative meaning to the dream about Sam drowning is that Sam is about to interact with someone who drowned someone in a barrel of seawater in A Feast for Crows, and that's Euron Greyjoy down in Old Town. So I kind of wonder whether that's intended as foreshadowing for Sam's eventual encounter with the Crow's Eye, which would be I thought about it that way, that Sam might end up dying at the hands of Euron.
Oh, geez.
Possibly in the Winds of Winter. I mean, if it makes some sense that this type of drowning is associated with Euron and with the Ironborn so fiercely. And I think that's an awful thing to think about, but it's interesting.
Well, I think that might be our answer right there. Not that it's the answer, but it certainly makes sense with everything that they're doing. That would not be fun. After he found that library in the place that he loves so much. I don't know. He's going to have a lot of help in Old Town, though. And I can't wait till we get there and the read-through, because there's going to be so much fascinating stuff that we can dig into. It's going to make the horn look easy. You know what I mean? It's going to make it look like, it's just like, okay. But I think we're ignoring Ed's dream as well, which, I mean, could be equally prophetic and happen in this chapter as well. He says that he dreamed he was pissing off the wall when someone decided to give him the horn, or when someone decided to give the horn a toot. Not that I'm complaining, it was better than my old dream where Harma Dog's Head was feeding me to her pigs.
And then John says, Harma's dead, but the pigs aren't.
Yeah. And this is John, you know, we're talking about larger issue things in the story, but I think it's important to note that John is going through a change in the dynamic of his relationship with his friends and his men, and the people that opposed him before are definitely taking him more seriously after executing Janos Slint. But the fact remains that he's no longer John. Come sit with us, have some of this mulled wine, or come have some of this beer. It's John has to meet up with Clytus, you know, and enjoy it shortly, and then retire to his bedchamber alone. Not that it has to be that way, but he knows that it needs to be that way.
What's kind of interesting about him retiring alone, and also speaks to a short scene in the chapter itself, is that John is trying to make himself out to be a good leader, and he's trying to embody Ned's principles that Ned taught him, which is that you shouldn't become too friendly with your subordinates, because you might have to send them out to die, or you might have to punish them. Which is kind of a sad state of affairs for John, is because John, for once in his entire life in the Night's Watch, has found fellowship and friendship with these people, these other outcasts and former outlaws. But now he has to like put them aside and try and be the leader that he feels that Ned would want him to be. And that's really kind of tragic for him, that he does everything alone and he ends up not having anyone that he can really confide in. His advisors are people that he doesn't agree with and doesn't really like, the Bowen Marshes, the Otho Yarwicks, and all those types of people that he doesn't really have a whole lot of respect for. But he has to, those are the ones that he ends up spending most of his time talking with and not confiding in his friends that he knows are out for his good interest and knows that they're not going to do anything bad against him. And that's it's sad, and it might prove fatal for John in the future, as he's alone without any friends, and as the book progresses, and he keeps sending more and more of his friends away to different castles that he's trying to restore along the wall.
What do you guys think about him sending Haldr and Tod off to Shadow Tower, Grin and Pip to Eastwatch? Because right now they're his closest friends because Aemon and Sam are gone. Do you think that decision was a decision that a good leader should make, or do you think that he's making a grave mistake thinking that that's something Ned would have done?
It depends if they're the right men for the job to go out and do what he needs them to do. Could it be that he's also trying to protect them in some way? I've thought about that a little bit, but I think, you know, when we did the last John chapter, and Sam and Gilly and Maester Aemon were all sent away, I think that's the recurring theme for John in these chapters, is that he's sending away people that are close to him and could be allies in the future. And I think the more that he does that, and the more that he has the kind of conversations that he does and with, you know, the Bowen Marshes of the world, and he makes the decisions that he makes, it's going to spell trouble for him. And I'm not entirely sure why he continues to send people away. I don't know if it's a mix of he feels like they have jobs to do elsewhere, or it's protection, or it's a combination of those things. I struggle with that. But I think that the decisions that he's making now are, as Jeff said, they're going to come back to haunt him.
Yeah. It's tough because the Night's Watch is so few actual Night's Watchmen after losing so many men at the Fist of the First Men and on the march back to Castle Black. And the fact is that, you know, Ed might not be the best person for the job, or Pip might not be the best person to go to Eastwatch, but he doesn't really have a lot of options about who to send. He could send Alistair Thorne someplace, but John is rightfully fearful that Alistair will stir up people against John, and it'll make more problems than solve if he sends him away. So he is probably rationalizing it in such a way that he thinks that if he sends his friends forward, they won't be stirring up rebellion or mutiny or any of these other things that are going to have really poor consequences for John. But it has poor consequences anyways, because by the end of John's arc, he's essentially alone. None of his friends are around him. He's surrounded by people that despise him in the Night's Watch and the Wildlings. That's all he has left. That are around him, and that makes for a really lethal concoction when we come to John's final chapters at the end of the book.
And Stannis, I would say too, is, you know, at least if not a friend, a protector of sorts. And as soon as he vacates the wall, I think that's John's last real hope walking out the door.
Well, for now, this is his lot from now until the end of his days.
Or maybe not.
Well, at least in this life, right? Maybe
right,
the first
life.
One.
Yeah, the first life.
Which I thought was just a fascinating way, just a last bit of foreshadowing from George R. R. Martin. And my final note for the chapter was just all caps, can't wait for wins. These two chapters that have such far-reaching implications come by and remind me of how wonderful the rest of the story is going to be. It's a real treat. And I have a feeling that that's how it's going to be for the most part for the rest of this read through. A lot of different things that we have seen resolved in different ways in the books are obviously going to be there for us. And it's going to be fun reliving those instances and getting to understand them even greater. But when we come by chapters that have such far reaching potential, like the possibility of a Euron and Sam showdown, it's really exciting.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Should we do it?
All right, let's do the owns. Yeah, so for the Davos chapter, I'll give my own to Salador San, who says, "He is promising me gold and gems, always promising, but this gold I have not seen. I have his word. He is saying, oh yes, his royal word. He writes it down. Can Salador San eat the king's word? Can he quench his thirst with parchments and waxy seals? Can he turn their promises into a feather bed and fuck them till they squeal?" And obviously, I don't do it the same justice as the actor who plays Salador San, but
I liked it. That's good.
I laughed when I read that.
Could have put a little Cotter Pike in there. Your Cotter Pike's magnificent. My own for the Davos chapter is tough, because so much is good. I think I definitively wrote in my notes going through it that my own goes to George R. R. Martin for writing this chapter, which I know is a bit lame, but after I read the line, "A little piracy to help the leagues go by," I just thought fondly of the perspective that he was putting there and the kind of story. And I was always really grateful for that when we read the Greyjoy stuff, or when I read the Greyjoy stuff as well, because I was like, this kind of story didn't have to be put into the Song of Ice and Fire. You know what I mean? Like, we didn't have to get pirate lore and hear the mind of an insane ship captain as he travels to an insane destination for an insane goal. But we got it. And it's really cool, because it would have been awesome on its own. But the fact that we got it with everything else, we got to experience it in a book that we have Tyrion and John and Davos and the list goes on, is pretty cool. Also thought about giving it to the description of the large bread trencher of Sister Stew, because it was just ridiculous and gluttonous and enjoyed by all. But I'll let you guys go look at that, because that's a whole long paragraph and I've already given two owns. I forget what my third one was, so it can't have been that great.
My own for the Davos chapter goes to Ned Stark. When he's back in during the day in Robert's Rebellion, he's at Sisterton, and everyone besides Godric Borel is telling his father, Godric's father, to kill Ned. But Ned says, "In this world, only winter is certain. We may lose our heads. It's true. But what if we prevail?" And I think that's really cool to get just another Ned line this late in the book, four books after he's died, and to hear Ned talking sense and being a really shrewd and cutting political operator, and talking his way out of being executed by these people with these web fingers. So I think that's a really cool Ned line there.
That's a great one.
And then for the John chapter, I like John's, I guess the own goes to both John and Mance, where John is talking about the Dornishmans, where he's thinking about Mance, and he's thinking about the song that Mance used to sing. In fact, it's the song that Mance is first singing to John when John approaches goes into his tent in a storm of swords, where he says, "Brothers are brothers, my days are done. The Dornishmans taken my life. But what does it matter, for all men must die? And I've tasted the Dornishman's wife."
I like it.
I'm going to put Bronn singing it behind you. You read your own.
Awesome.
I'll give my own to Clytus. It's just completely random, but it was when he was having the conversation with John at the end of the chapter, and he was referencing a line from good old Maester Aemon, and it says, "Many good men have been bad kings," Maester Aemon used to say, "and some bad men have been good kings." I just like that line.
It's a good line.
I'm going to give my own to Melisandre for managing the execution of Mance Rayder without a hitch. I think we only know of one wildling going crazy enough to be murdered and thrown onto the pile of fire. When there's a fresh pile of fire close by and Melisandre is leveled up to this level of execution, it's not something that is on the shores outside of Dragonstone that is very well controlled by people and soldiers of her, you know, group. It's not like this is Stannis' kingdom. He's the king there, sure, but you're surrounded by wildlings, surrounded by men of the Night's Watch, and I think that she managed the situation particularly well. So, good job, Melisandre.
Very nice.
Well, those are our owns. I know a couple of listeners sent theirs in as well.
On Facebook, Alma Lidman Bring writes, "Davos, own to Sister Stew. Good choice. For making me really hungry. Honorable mention to yet another red herring regarding Jon Snow's parentage." That's true. "John, own to Dolorous Ed for the line, 'I, we hacked their gods apart and made them burn the pieces, but we gave them onion soup.' What's a god compared to a nice bowl of onion soup?"
And our good friend Brienne over on Twitter says, "Davos' own goes to the Sistermen for being those weird neighbors who actually turn out to be really cool."
It's like questionable at first, but you know what?
And John's own goes to, quote, "The women are the strong ones, truly."
And then she puts a Breaking Bad gif, which haunts Micah's dreams because of his relationship with Breaking Bad.
You're goddamn right. Thanks to Brienne, of course, for always contributing. And we look forward to her and many other owns for next week's chapters, which are Daenerys 2 and Reek 1.
Those two chapters are great. The Daenerys 2 chapter is a really interesting chapter, which talks about Dany's worldview and some of her thematic and inner conflict, which is going to play a huge role in her story going forward. I love that chapter. But that Reek chapter, man, that
is so good.
It's so good, but it's so fucked up.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, thanks for joining us on Football Day of all days, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. It's a lot of fun.
I echo what Zach said. Thanks, Jeff, for jumping on. You gave me a lot more insight into the chapters than I had reading them, so I really appreciate that.
Well, the same goes for
likewise
for you guys back to me. I mean, I think you guys gave me a lot to think about. Maybe something to write about at some point down the road if time allows. But
that sacrifice question got you, didn't it?
It did. It really got me. I'm still like kind of turning my mind over it right now. So
I feel like that's been happening to me throughout the course of this read through, and I'm really excited that we have so much left to do. And I think that it might be possible. We joked about it last week, but I don't know. Like, what is your official word? Like, what do you think about the Winds of Winter? Because I know that George mentioned stuff in regards to the con and writing, and we have official word from his publishers, but you know, we've got a lot of food to get through in this feast. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's the $1 million question is when's it going to come out, and more importantly, where the story is headed from these two books that he's written. And I think it's interesting in that a lot of the stuff from these two chapters that we read about and that we talked about were looked to have some sort of impact on the future of the story going forward. Is Melisandre, are her sacrifices going to be worth it? Do they mean anything? Davos, are those night lamps, are they going to have an impact on Stannis' story in the Winds of Winter? It's an outstanding question, and it's one that I'm very eager to get answers to. But again, George took 11 years to write both A Feast for Crows and A Dance of Dragons. And the fact that we spent an hour and a half or so talking about these two chapters.
And there's more to talk about.
Oh yeah. There's tons more to talk about. And it means that the time that George has spent writing these chapters, and the time that he spent working on The Winds of Winter, which is now almost or is over 5 years, you're looking forward to it and hoping and praying that the book that we're going to get is going to be as masterful as these two books are. And that's really something that I'm excited to see. And I think judging from those Winds sample chapters that he's read or he's released, I think it's the quality of the writing is continued, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of it as it unfolds.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that any better, honestly. But I will say, for our listeners, if you would like to send in some questions in addition to your own, there is a number of ways that you can do so. You can tweet at us at Game of Owns on Twitter, scroll upon our Facebook wall at facebook.com/Game of Owns, or send us an email at contact@GameOfOwns.com. And of course, Jeff, if people want to find you and all your masterful work, where can they do that?
So I'm on Twitter at Brendan B. Fish, and my website is warsandpoliticsspiceandfire.wordpress.com, where you can find some of the writing that I've done on.
We'll link to it.
Yeah, it's done a lot of writing on some of these chapters and on Davos, and I just actually wrapped up some writing on Davos too, but it's a little spoilery for right now, but if you've read the books and you're interested in seeing possibly where Davos's story direction might go in the future, then check it out.
And come back for our next episode. The feast continues.
Come back with some Emmys.